You see, most liberals think that if you can find the middle of anything and squat there, that somehow or another virtue has been achieved.
I just have to respond to the, I mean, the dripping contempt in her voice. I mean, wow.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Eric Klein, and on today's program, we're going to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the radio station KPFA and the Pacifica Radio Network, the first listener-supported radio station in the world, in the country. I laughed, and I used an up talk in my voice because it's a question mark. Using the term firsts, as we've learned from our resident college radio historian, Jennifer Waits, co-producer of this program, is dangerous and very tempting in human language. But we do know that Pacifica Radio, as a listener-supported radio station, really did, well, it did some important historical work. Founded in 1949, 75 years ago, this Monday of this program airing, and founded by pacifists in the wake of World War II. The radio station and the radio network that came out of it evolved a lot in those 75 years. And the conversation that I'm bringing you today, the radio interview, will cover part of that history. Matthew Lazar is a co-producer of Radio Survivor, often heard on these airwaves, but not often enough. And he sat down with Brian Edwards Tiekert, the producer and host of the KPFA morning show called Upfront.
75 years ago today, a volunteer named Gertrude Chiarito threw a switch in a set of hastily constructed studios in downtown Berkeley and put KPFA on the air for the very first time. It was aiming to be the world's first successful experiment in listener-supported broadcasting, and the concept was introduced on the airwaves by a former conscientious objector.
In time past, many romantic feelings were associated with radio broadcasting, but KPFA itself is a real place only a few steps up from the street, an instrument for real thought and serious intercourse, an integrating aspect of the community.
That's the voice of KPFA co-founder Lewis Hill. To celebrate this birthday, we're going to bring you an interview we did with social historian Matthew Lazar. He's a professor of history at UC Santa Cruz. He has written two books about this place. His book about KPFA's early years is entitled Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network.
Hi, Brian.
I want to start with the voice we just heard, the most iconic figure involved in founding KPFA, Lou Hill. Who was he?
Well, he's a man who was born and raised in the Oklahoma-Missouri area, and he was the son of the one of the heads of the state legislature of Oklahoma, and he was the nephew of Frank Phillips, who was the patriarch of the big Phillips 66 oil petroleum empire of the Southwest. He used to visit Frank Phillips in his big medieval castle, which he owned, and when he was 12 or 13 years old, his father, who considered himself to be quite a philosopher and even a poet, suddenly surprised young Lewis Hill and sent him off to Wentworth Military Academy, which was a military school, which I think is not what Lewis Hill had expected to happen to him. And I think Lewis Hill pretty much hated Wentworth, although he did try to make the best of it. I finally got from Wentworth some years ago a picture of Lewis Hill. He was apparently the editor of the school newspaper, and there's a charming photograph of him sort of looking like a he's in shirt sleeves with a tie, and he looks like a sort of a city editor, except that he's only 14 years old, but he's doing a pretty good imitation of it. And it's probably at this place that he became a pacifist, or he began reading pacifist literature. He eventually fled from Wentworth Military Academy, and he went to Stanford, where he fell in with the pacifist student clubs of the late 1930s and became part of the pacifist movement that was very, very popular in the United States in the late 1930s, as it seemed like the United States was headed back into another world war.
So the pacifist movement literally comprises over a million people in the United States.
Well, what's important to remember about pacifism back then was that it was a really big movement, that there were a lot of people in the United States who were pacifists. I'm going to offend some of your listeners and say that my assessment is that pacifism is largely a dead ideology at this point. There are still pockets of people who call themselves pacifists, but nothing like what was pacifism was in the late 19th and early 20th century. In 1939, Time magazine did a survey of U.S. pacifists. They put a big picture on their article identifying one man named A.J. Mustey as America's number one pacifist. Can you imagine Time magazine today writing an article about America's number one pacifist? It seems very unlikely. You know, Gandhi, pacifism really fit into all of the Victorian sensibilities against violence and sexuality of the late 19th century. And then there was Gandhi. He really had a lot of purchase. And also, lots of people in the United States were very, very disillusioned with the results of World War I. Tremendous disillusionment with World War I by the late 1930s, a belief that America had been snookered into the war. There had been a lot of repression of civil liberties, and a lot of people didn't want to do that again. And so the pacifist movement, with all its various tendencies, some secular, many religious, sort of fell very nicely into this generalized anti-war sentiment that emerged and that was part and parcel of the America First movement associated with Charles Lindbergh and others in the late 1930s. And Lewis Hill was part of that. And then came Pearl Harbor, and the United States was declared war upon by Germany, and the United States became part of World War II. And suddenly, all of these intellectual pacifists found themselves being taken away from a mainstream American life where they were sort of the toast of the town and shunned off into these remote conscientious objectors camps all kinds of remote places in the United States, Waltport, all of the Colville, California is kind of the armpit of California up north, all these remote places. And Lewis Hill was sitting around with his friend Roy Finch, who was another conscientious objector and kind of a radical anarchist pacifist. And they were saying, what went wrong? How did we get here? You know, we were just a couple of minutes ago, we were America's number one pacifist on Time magazine. And now here we are, you know, building little trails with rocks and stuff like that and, you know, packing sandwiches at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, to go out in the freezing weather. What went wrong? And Hill was very involved in the pacifist movement that was very, very intense during the Second World War, in which lots of conscientious objectors went on strike against being in CPS. It's a forgotten fact that one-fifth of all men in federal prison during the Second World War were conscientious objectors. And, you know, he came out of the experience thinking that we really need, or pacifists really need, to build institutions that reintegrate themselves and re-legitimize themselves in American life after the Second World War. And he began talking about a radio station which was run by pacifists but really invited everybody into a public discussion about the great questions of war and peace. And after the Second World War, Lewis Hill went to Washington, D.C. First, briefly, he worked for the American Civil Liberties Union as an advocate for pacifists. And then he went to Washington, D.C., and he worked for a commercial radio station in Washington, D.C. I believe it was WINX. He went to learn the ropes. And as you can hear from that excerpt, he had a really nice voice. I mean, he had a real BBC kind of third program voice. It was really smooth. And he got a job as a news announcer. One day they handed him a piece of paper, something to read, about a concentration camp for Japanese Americans, events that were taking place in a concentration camp for Japanese Americans, one of the many unconscionable concentration camps that were set up by the United States government during World War II. For Japanese Americans. And he, of course, was appalled by this. He had visited one of them. And he read this and he immediately knew from his own contacts and from his own experience that this article was not true, and he refused to read it. And, they said, well, come on, man, you can't refuse to read things because you think that they're not true. Who do you think you're dealing with here? And he simply walked out of the job, and he and his wife, Joy, decided to head back to the San Francisco Bay Area because they thought that the San Francisco Bay Area was the best place where they could possibly put together some kind of a radio station as they envisioned it. A lot of cooperatives in San Francisco Bay Area, a lot of, you know, kind of communal experiments were already taking place. It had already sort of established itself as a place where a lot of that stuff was happening. And they really saw KPFA or fitting into that.
So how does he come to the conclusion that listener sponsorship is the model you need to run a radio station? It hadn't been done before.
Well, it had been tried before. Mm-hmm. Listener sponsorship was an intuitive idea that Lewis Hill had not invented. There had been experiments with listener sponsorship in Missouri, actually. This is very intriguing to me, and I wish I had followed up on it more. But there were experiments in voluntary contribution radio stations in the Missouri area. And in the 1930s, somebody actually filed with the FCC to create a listener-supported radio station. But of course, it was the 1930s, and nobody had any money, right? So this was an idea that was waiting for an economic recovery and the right place and the right time. So Lewis Hill wasn't the first person to invent this idea, but he was the first person to execute the idea and to make it work.
Let's talk for a moment about the voices in the early years of KPFA. Talk about how this idea about the radio station involving a larger public in a conversation with pacifists, how it actually confronted the reality of running a successful radio station on this model.
Well, if you look at early programming, early public affairs programming, first of all, if you look at KPFA by and large, what you see is a classical music radio station in the early years. Lewis Hill started out, he wanted to create a radio, an AM radio station in Richmond, California. He's
a working class radio station.
A working class radio station, a radio station that was going to broadcast to the masses. And he couldn't get one. He couldn't get an AM station because everybody had them. And he just simply couldn't justify a new signal to the Federal Communications Commission. So he settled for a new technology that was almost entirely marginalized during this time, FM radio. FM radio has a long and very difficult history at this point. It was invented in the mid-1930s by a man named William Howard Armstrong, and it was largely suppressed by RCA in cahoots with the Federal Communications Commission because David Sarnoff, the head of RCA, really didn't want to invest in didn't want a competitor to his AM, and he wanted FM for television. So FM stations were, you know, poor and easily available in the mid 1940s. So he got one, and it broadcast to the area of Berkeley. So few people had FM receivers that he had to sell FM receivers to his subscribers. And of course, I'm sure that there's a box here around, but there are people around who still have the KPFA built FM receiver, which was known as the subscriber, which rather charmingly has a dial for all the numbers, but then it has KPFA. You know, the notch for 94.1 has a great big KPFA on it, just in case you miss anything.
I mean, what's interesting is that the first successful listener-supported radio station in the world doesn't start out with listener support. It starts with this person, Lou Hill, who's born to privilege, who's comfortable moving in relatively elite circles, circulating prospectuses and raising money without the benefit of any airwaves from
acquaintances. Well, it shut down. You know, it went on the air. You know, the Pacifica Foundation was founded in 1946, first foundation. Board was basically five conscientious objectors, Lewis Hill among them. And then they opened the station up in 1949. In 1950, it shut down. I mean, they couldn't get enough money. They had a big community meeting, and they managed to get the people who already were listening to cough up about $10,000, which was quite a lot of money for such a small group of people. And then they went on with it again. And then Lewis Hill, because he was Lewis Hill was a pragmatist. Even though he was a pacifist and a conscientious objector, he wanted to make the thing work. He went to this new foundation that had emerged just after the Second World War, which was the Ford Foundation, which was the largest moneyed foundation probably in history. Huge amount of money, perhaps as much as $500 million, which is a lot of money for a foundation back then. Its staff set it up in Pasadena, California, and affectionately referred to the place as Itching Palms. And Dwight MacDonald wrote a book about it. He called it a large body of money surrounded by people who want some. And Hill went there and he managed to get a Ford Foundation grant from them for, I think, about $100,000, $150,000. And that's what really kept KPFA going for the next few years.
Here is Lou Hill 8 years down the line in 1957, gloating about how the station's finances have stabilized.
When the station started broadcasting 8 years ago today, it had a cash reserve of about $1,700. And, of course, there were no subscribers at all. Here, 8 years later, the cash reserve of KPFA, I mean as of today and in the bank, is, as a matter of fact, a little less than $1,700. But we've had all these years of broadcasting, nevertheless, and we mean to have many more. It just goes to show, as someone remarked lately, what can happen when a crazy idea is joined with sufficiently stubborn dispositions. Now there are about 5,300 subscribers. So here's to 10,000. The real difference between now and then is that we know now that it can be done.
KPFA co-founder Lewis Hill speaking in 1957. We're speaking with Matthew Lazar, social historian who teaches at UC Santa Cruz, writes about media and politics, and has authored two histories of this radio station and the network it gave birth to. I want to talk for a minute about what it actually meant to have this radio station on the air in the 1950s. We brandish the slogan free speech radio. But in fact, Lewis Hill and other people running the radio station were constantly put into positions where they had to censor the things they put on the air.
Well, they were brave at the same time that they were cautious. For example, they broadcast Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
In the mid-1950s.
Starving, hysterical, naked.
And they also broadcast it late at night, and they cut it up.
KPFA has edited out two or three words or brief passages in the poem, simply as a matter of taste. I think you may feel assured, however, in what you're going to hear, that the full essence of what has provoked the San Francisco Police Department into the arrest of Mr. Ferlinghetti is still present.
Allen Ginsberg's Howl at the time, the copies of it that had been printed by City Lights Press
had been confiscated by the police, and there was a trial.
An obscenity trial.
Yes, that's right. So Hill was very concerned that the station broadcast it, but also that the station cut parts of it enough so that the station wouldn't get into trouble. What's the most interesting thing about that broadcast is that shortly before they played the poem, they got a roundtable discussion of people. They got Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
I was arrested during the first week in June. The charge was selling allegedly obscene literature.
They got a lawyer, they got a librarian, and they got a bunch of other people. And Lewis Hill went on the air and he said, you know, I'm really disappointed, but we couldn't get the police department to come here.
Namely, Captain Hanrahan of the police department, the head of the juvenile squad, I believe, and Mr. McPhee of Customs, and Mr. Harold McKinnon, head of the police commission of San Francisco. We had hoped to have one or more of these gentlemen present to discuss the issues in your case, Mr. Ferlinghetti. Unfortunately, none of them could consent to appear in this program.
We invited the police department and they wouldn't come. So we should restrict ourselves to information rather than to congratulating ourselves on our agreement on the idea that Howl should not be censored. And I think that that points to early KPFA's really strong belief that everyone should have an opportunity to speak on KPFA, including conservatives, right-wingers, Daughters of the American Revolution, and all the other groups of people whom the Berkeley audience probably at that time didn't approve of and don't approve of now.
Hill's idea was that there was something transformative in demonstrating that you could have a civil debate across severe differences.
If you look at early Pacifica Radio roundtable discussions, they are full of people with very different ideas. I mean, they're full of discussions between people across the ideological spectrum. They tried very hard to do that in the early, in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And we should appreciate the fact that they tried to do that with no money.
Well, it takes a great deal of time.
And
often that time has to be paid for.
And often that time has to be paid for. You have to convince people to come on the air. You have to prepare. So these are things that need preparation and work. And they really tried to make that work in the late 1940s and early 1950s. The first thing that they ran into was a lack of money to do it. And the second thing they ran into was McCarthyism.
So one of your theses is that basically KPFA starts out with this intention of being a space for dialogue, getting all views onto the air. But the rapid and radical changes in American politics force it into a posture of being a refuge for dissent rather than a platform for everything.
Well, I think that the original vision was sort of twofold. One was is that the pacifists who started it saw dialogue as this kind of transformative process. They also saw them controlling the dialogue and them asking the questions as a way to legitimize pacifism in a subtle way rather than just getting on the air. You know, somebody said to Lewis Hill in 1944, why don't you just start a magazine? And he said, there have already been enough magazines which list all of the shenanigans which are inimitable to a world of brotherhood. Those were more or less his exact words. You can hear the sarcasm in his voice. He doesn't want a protest radio station. That's not what he wants. What he wants is a radio station in which everybody is going to listen and pacifists are controlling the questions. You know, is atomic energy going to hurt our civil liberties? That's one of their questions. Is world government a good thing or a bad thing in our lifetime? This is the way that they wanted to do it. They wanted to legitimize themselves. They wanted to embed themselves within a larger discussion for everybody that they controlled. And that was the original idea.
And this is during a period, a very brief period before Cold War McCarthyism starts to rear its ugly head.
Right.
Where, for instance, it is within the acceptable range of political discourse at Washington to propose putting the entire nuclear arsenal under the control of the United Nations.
Right. Actually, what's interesting is that McCarthyism sort of got to Pacifica Radio kind of late. 1957, 1958, 1959 is when the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee started investigating Pacifica Radio and got the FBI to dossier just about everybody who was in the organization and then dragged the organization in for public hearings. And the organization had to come up with some kind of a justification for itself. And it came up with a justification that had already been used by previous victims of McCarthyism, alternative magazine typewriters, and basically said, "What Pacifica Radio is for is it's for the marginalized point of view, it's for the dissenter, it's for the point of view that you don't hear in mainstream America, and it is a bastion of free speech and the right to speak for those people." And this was kind of a revision of Pacifica's mission.
This is also kind of a turning point for McCarthyism. One of the most memorable moments when KPFA's broadcasters are pulled up is when Sovietologist Bill Mandel goes to testify.
What you're talking about is when he is subpoenaed to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee in San Francisco in 1960.
And at this point, there are students protesting in the hearing who've come over from UC Berkeley.
And from Berkeley High School.
And here's what Bill Mandel had to say.
Honorable beaters of children and sadists uniformed and in plain clothes, distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman, eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
Many people who write the history of the McCarthy period credit those hearings in San Francisco as being a turning point.
Actually, what's interesting is yes, it's people starting to stand up. It's sort of this moment, this remarkable moment when all these students, basically they were attacked by the police and they fought back. And the police arrested them for rioting when in fact it was the police who had rioted. and there were a series
of throwing them down the stone steps in front of the hearing and spraying
them with fire hoses. And what UAC did was that they made a film.
The communist apparatus activated its trained agitators and propagandists in the San Francisco Bay Area months before the scheduled hearings were to begin,
thinking that they could generate public support. It was called Operation Abolition. They made a film about this, thinking that they could generate public support for UAC by showing all these students persecuting them. And it was shown around college campuses all around the United States, and it generated enormous support for the anti-UAC movement.
When asked about his role as a communist in lecturing before the communist-conceived California Labor School in San Francisco, William Mandel replies,
"This question has no purpose other than to harass me. When I was asked this question last in 1943 by the late Joe McCarthy, and let me say that I am honored when people come up to me on the streets, perhaps I don't deserve this honor, and say, you're the man who killed Joe McCarthy."
Bill Mandel and KPFA made a documentary about the UAC riots, and that helped put Pacifica Radio on the map. By this time, there are now three Pacifica radio stations. There's KPFK in Los Angeles, and there's WBAI in New York City, KPFK organized by the Pacifica Foundation, and WBAI donated to the Pacifica Foundation by a philanthropist named Louis Schweitzer. So now it's a three-network organization, and they're playing all this stuff about UAC on these stations. And in the midst of late McCarthyism, they're generating enormous support for this new mission of Pacifica Radio as the dissent network. They're having on ex-FBI agents spilling the beans about J. Edgar Hoover.
I was instructed to begin actually seeking people out to conduct bombings and actually be an individual who would lead a series of bombings. That struck me as slightly unconstitutional.
And of course, once they put on that show about what it was really like inside the FBI, Hoover, as I'd mentioned before, dossiered the organization and then the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee dragged everybody in the Pacifica Foundation board to public hearings. They had private hearings before the Federal Communications Commission. They almost lost their licenses. It was quite an ordeal, but they managed to survive it. And by that time, they had gone from being this dialogue network to being a kind of a dissent network.
What did that actually translate into in terms of the station sound?
I think it meant many more advocacy programs, many of which were quite famous and quite admirable, airing of the Vietnam teach-ins in UC Berkeley.
Listen, Lyndon Johnson, you've gone too far this time. You are a bully with an Air Force. And since you will not call off your Air Force, there are young people who will persecute you back.
The Pacifica Foundation's radio stations were really the first radio stations, the first broadcasting organization to really question the war in Vietnam. And this is in 1963 and 1964, when most Americans still supported the war and supported Lyndon Johnson's escalating the war. The war was not unpopular at this time.
It will hound you. For listen, this is only one of the thousand things they will do. They will go on marches and they will make demonstrations. And they will begin a war of public protest against you, which will never cease. It will go on and on, and it will get stronger and stronger.
It's really not until 1967, 1968, that a critical mass of Americans turn against the war. At this time, it was not only unpopular, but physically dangerous to be against the war in Vietnam. People were shot. They were beaten on the streets. I saw this myself. As a young person in New York City. And so it was very courageous for the Pacifica Foundation to do this. It was not popular. It was not anything that could be characterized in retrospect as politically correct.
And I guess the theme running through all of this is that what makes it possible for Pacifica to stand up to McCarthyism, to stand up to the FBI, to be so outspokenly opposed to the Vietnam War, was that it didn't have a small set of advertisers or patrons who could be chased away by government spooks.
Louis Hill regarded advertising as a threat to to his mission. He saw advertisers as individuals who could control programming, get skittish about programming, and force money-wary business managers to come in and say, don't run that program. He saw advertising as a threat to what he was trying to do. And it should be noted that during the McCarthy era, advertisers had tremendous power. And there were many advertisers in the United States who, you know, supermarkets, which were owned by right-wing individuals, who really stepped in to the programming process, particularly in early television, and forced people to be fired, forced people to be marginalized, forced shows off the air. Lewis Hill was very aware that all of this was happening. He understood that advertising was a source of censorship.
So as KPFA and Pacifica move more comfortably into this dissenting role, the voice, the manager that most comes to shape the sound of the stations is someone named Elsa Knight Thompson. Here we have her in an interview, a highly friendly interview, with Paul Robeson.
I have in the studio with me Paul Robeson, who needs no introduction, and Harold Winkler, who is president of Pacifica Foundation, which operates KPFA, as most of you know. Mr. Robeson has been known and loved as an artist all over the world for many years, but he has also, I believe, attracted considerable and worldwide attention in his role as a world citizen and as a person who was very deeply concerned about the society in which he lived. I wonder, Mr. Robeson, if we could kick off by asking, when did you first become involved in the political aspects of...
May I first say how happy I am and privileged to be with you here, and how deeply I thank this station for its kindness throughout the years. I've been on two or three others this time, but always have been, know I've had a welcome here, so I want to thank you.
Something of a contrast to Lewis Hill's admonishment about let's not just congratulate ourselves about how much we agree with each other.
Elsa Knight Thompson's philosophy was that you just say what you think. You just say what you think is true. You just put it out there. You give your audience an opportunity to understand what the truth is, and then you just tell the truth. She had very little tolerance for this idea that we should have all of these people who disagree with each other on the air. She once had some kind of a fight with Trevor Thomas in which they were both listening to comments coming in on the air. And Trevor Thomas, who was the general manager of the station and someone with whom she was at odds a large portion of the time, said, "Where are the people who disagree with us? Where are our enemies? Why aren't they listening to the station?" And she rather contemptuously said to him, "Well, Trevor, if you can't count on your enemies, you may as well just count on your friends." And I think that she was very comfortable with the advocacy role that Pacifica Radio was moving into. And it should be noted that in that context, she really produced some very historic stuff. She produced what is arguably the first gay rights documentary. She had on various members of the Mattachine Society in the late 1950s.
Tell us something about what the Mattachine Society is, what its general purposes are.
Yes, the Mattachine Society is an incorporated nonprofit organization that is engaged in examining and doing something about the problems that face the homosexual in our country today.
And they talked about gay rights. You know, they talked about gay rights, the right of gay people to go into restaurants, to go into the parks, and not be arrested and not be incarcerated by the police. And I interviewed gay people who listened to that program when it was broadcast in 1959. And they knew that it was going to happen because they all knew about the Mattachine Society. They were alerted that it was going to be on the air. And they sat in dinner parties and listened to it in complete shocked silence that someone would actually say the word homosexual on the air and not say that it was a bad thing. It was a completely astounding moment for a lot of people that they would hear this on the radio. Fresh air, free air, somebody said to me. It was great.
One of the first things that I do in working with a person who has homosexual tendencies is to begin the process of self-acceptance in him.
she gets into a bit of a tug of war with some of the old guard at KPFA, including Trevor Thomas, who you mentioned. Here's a clip from her in a debate between the two of them on the air over the direction of the station.
You see, most liberals think that if you can find the middle of anything and squat there, that somehow or another virtue has been achieved.
I just have to respond to the dripping contempt in her voice. I mean, wow. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, the radio station has 168 hours a week to dish out in terms of programming. It doesn't seem like you have to choose between dialogue and dissent. You can do both under the same roof. What accounted for the vitriol that you hear in her voice there?
I think that when I was doing research for my book, I interviewed people who would only talk about Elsa Knight Thompson off the record. And even though she was long gone from this plane of reality, spoke to me about her with fear in their voice and described how she set up a room, a special office in KPFA's old headquarters in which she could see everybody who was coming in and out of the building. And basically more or less kept a dossier on everybody in the place, and mostly mentored men and refused to mentor women. Gertrude Chiarino, who you mentioned earlier, didn't like her very much for that reason, as did other women in the organization, who just basically saw her as someone who was only going to mentor men and not women. She was someone who felt very strongly that she knew what direction Pacifica Radio should go and she should control all of the public affairs airtime. And in fairness to her, she did a great job for a while. You know, she produced a lot of really historical programming and became a kind of a role model for a lot of people. There were a lot of producers and a lot of people who went off into the rest of the emergent public broadcasting universe and produced marvelous stuff based on the inspiration that they got from Elsa Knight Thompson. But by 1972, 1973, 1974, as a whole lot of new people with new identities are coming into the Pacifica network, her ideas and her my way or the highway attitude is getting kind of old.
The other thing we have her to thank for is the sound of the modern fun drive.
Well, not just her. There's a lot of interesting cross-incubation that's going on in the San Francisco Bay Area between KPFA and KQED over this. KQED also pioneered the fun drive. It pioneered the fun drive in the early 1950s when it was about to go off the air and it was pretty desperate.
We're referring to KQED-TV, which went on the air long before the radio station.
Right, right. And they held what is arguably the first fun drive in the early 1950s. And there were people who were at KQED who also worked at KPFA and back and forth, just like there are now. And I think that there was this sort of cross-fertilization between KQED and KPFA. And the auction proved very good. It really worked very well. And I think that Trevor Thomas and other people and Elsa Knight Thompson saw that and they adapted that for radio. In the mid-1950s. And the fun drive is really the way that Pacifica kept itself going.
That was the voice of Matthew Lassar, who is a co-founder of Radio Survivor, the radio program you're listening to now, speaking with Brian Edwards-Tiekert, host of the KPFA morning show known as Up Front. That interview was originally recorded in 2013, but it also aired just this week on KPFA to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the founding of the radio station by Lewis Hill and his co-workers, his friends, his comrades, 75 years ago. Of course, that history that Matthew Lassar has written two books about is also the history of, you know, left movements in the 20th century and the 21st century, although that's not what Matthew's book covers. But there's a secondary story to what KPFA is and what it has accomplished, is that the fact that it's the first, it proved the viability of the experiment of a listener-funded radio program. And here in the 21st century, 75 years later, we can see that there's another conversation to be had. There's another radio show to be produced on the topic of where we are now in the world of listener funding of content. You know, we really have seen an evolution of how media that is largely free or 100% free is supported by people that love that work and consume it. These days, it's really on a it's like atomized, if I could say that, because I think about Patreon, where that seems to be one of the more popular mechanisms for individuals who are creating media to get funding from their supporters. I also am aware of other times that podcasts have had fund drives that were, you know, successful and really inspired by that public radio model, the public radio model that we learned that KPFA was one of the originators of, along with KQED. I just learned that for the first time again. I'm sure I might have known that. It's just a conversation for a future date. Put a pin in it. Well, Matthew Lazar, who wrote two books on the history of Pacifica Radio, and that's why he was being interviewed by Brian on the KPFA airwaves. This is how Matthew puts his bio here on our website, Radio Survivor. Matthew Lazar is a co-founder of Radio Survivor and its business manager. He is the author of the book Radio 2.0, Uploading the First Broadcast Medium, and teaches history at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Matthew likes DJs, classical music, disco, post-punk, cats, free school lunches, dislikes money, ideologies, claims that technology will fix everything. I'll have to check in with Matthew to see if he has updated the list at all. Well, to round out today's radio program and podcast, we're going to listen to more of Matthew Lazar. In the early days of this podcast, back in 2015 when we launched episodes, the first few dozen episodes, Matthew would contribute a regular commentary that was more, they were micro-documentaries is what they were, and I'm going to play for you a handful of them. We're going to start with Matthew's micro-documentary about Paul Robeson, who was mentioned earlier in this interview.
This is Matthew Lazar with Lazar's Letter on Radio. According to the rules of anniversary journalism, the 76th birthday of anything isn't particularly significant. But this November 5th will mark the birthday of a radio event for which that number resonates. The premiere of the great baritone Paul Robeson singing the patriotic cantata Ballad for Americans on the CBS network.
In 76 the sky was red, thunder rumbling overhead, that King George couldn't sleep in his bed. And on that stormy morn, old Uncle Sam was born.
It was 1939, 2 months before the broadcast, Nazi troops invaded Poland, triggering what we now call World War II. A day before the performance, President Franklin Roosevelt signed a law letting the United States send weapons to England and France. No surprise, then, that this unabashedly patriotic choral piece found its way to the airwaves. Here's what you may find a little unsettling. Robeson and the man who composed the music, Earl Robinson, were both members of the Communist Party.
Old Sam put on a three-cornered hat, and in a Richmond church he sat, and Patrick Henry told him that, while America drew breath, it was liberty or death.
Why were commies producing love songs for Patrick Henry? Here's the simple version of a complicated story. Thanks to the crisis of the Great Depression, the American Communist Party was enjoying its heyday in American politics. But since Adolf Hitler's rise to power in Germany, Marxist-Leninists around the world had made a strategic decision to tacitly support governments that could be counted on to fight fascism, seen as the number one enemy of the Soviet Union. The American Communist Party muted that position after Soviet leader Joseph Stalin signed a strategic aggression pact with the Nazis. But many members of the party saw the deal as Stalin's attempt to buy time until an inevitable war broke out.
Thus, during the so-called Popular Front period of the 1930s, American communists framed their ideology as 20th century Americanism.
Nobody but anybody believed it. Everybody who was anybody, they doubted it. Nobody had faith. Nobody. Nobody but Washington, Tom Paine, Benjamin Franklin, Chaim Solomon, Crispus Attucks, Lafayette.
Ballad for Americans was a jumble of contradictions. Here was an African-American radical singing a song of praise to George Washington, a slaveholder. Here was an oratorical cry for liberty coming from supporters of Joseph Stalin, who in 1939 had in fact killed more innocent people than Hitler. And yet it was a beautiful, stirring piece of music, the lyrics penned by John Latouche, who would later write great songs like Taking a Chance on Love. Ballad for Americans was subsequently recorded by Bing Crosby. In 1940, it was sung at the American Communist Party's National Convention and the Republican Party's National Convention. Heck, my mother used to sing it to me. This is Matthew Lasar for the Radio Survivor podcast, with a reminder to scholars everywhere, if you want to understand the complicated history of the mid-20th century, you'd better listen to the radio. Thanks for considering my words.
For I have always believed it, and I believe it now, and you'll know who I am.
Who are you?
America.
That radio commentary, or as I'm calling them, micro-documentaries, was produced and recorded by Matthew Lasar back in August of 2015, possibly 2016, please forgive me. I'm airing them today because I like them, and also because we, on today's episode, listened to an interview that Matthew Lasar recorded in commemoration of the anniversary of the founding of Pacifica Radio. The next radio commentary that we're going to play, that Matthew also produced about 8 years ago, is about the Pacifica Radio Network. The next two are actually about the Pacifica Radio Network. We're going to move chronologically forward.
It's time once again for Lasar's Letter on Radio for the Radio Survivor podcast, and I am just agog at all the goodies in the Pacifica Radio Archives' ever-growing American Women Making History and Culture audio collection. Here's an excerpt from a 1971 Pacifica Station KPFA interview with anti-war activist Jane Fonda at the gates of Travis Air Force Base in Northern California.
Most of those bombs, not every one of them, but most of them, are bombs that according to international law are considered war crimes, anti-personnel bombs, napalm, white phosphorus, Agent Orange, all of the things that are dropping from the bellies of our airplanes made in this country are considered war crimes. So you have the military telling the soldiers, because they put on a uniform, they are no longer free to exercise their constitutional rights, when every day there are planes leaving from Travis Air Force Base that are breaking international law.
Jane Fonda being interviewed in 1971, and here is civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer when she ran for Congress in 1965.
And what I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything? So far it hadn't worked, and I'm sick of seeing this kind of stuff on paper. We want them to do something about it, because we are a part of America, because we didn't come here on our own. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human rights, not for equal rights.
Fannie Lou Hamer and Fonda are just the beginning of this collection. There are also interviews with Laurie Anderson, Mary Daly, Maxine Hong Kingston, Judy Chicago, Audre Lorde, Adrian Rich, Yoko Ono, Joan Baez, and Dolores Huerta. Lots of these interviews are in the late 1960s and early 1970s when these women were just getting started. There are also interviews with mostly forgotten women like abortion rights activist Sherry Finkbein and radical feminist Tigrace Atkinson. And of course, there's an interview with Betty Friedan making some very far-sighted comments about women work in the family. This is from an interview in 1976.
You say women need shorter hours a week so they can also pay attention to their families. That would be just used as an excuse not to hire more women. But if we now say everyone should work shorter hours so that women and men, because we now believe parenting should be equal, would have more time for their families if they are young women and men, and older women and men have more time for private, self-fulfilling, self-developing, you know, pursuits. And nobody wants to die of a heart attack prematurely or ulcers or strokes or live a life that's just solely devoted to breadwinning.
The comments of Betty Friedan, part of the Pacifica Radio Archives American Women Making History and Culture audio collection. You know you want to take a look at this. Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org and check it out. Matthew Lasar here for the Radio Survivor podcast. Thank you for listening to my words. Andrea Fraser of Performance Art fame has an interesting show scheduled for the Brava Theater in San Francisco. She's going to reenact the voices of four men talking about feminism on a discussion show at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles in 1972. Here's an excerpt from the program in question provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives.
I felt for many years extremely pressured financially, for one example. I felt that I had to be the breadwinner. I had to bring home the money. I had to take care of the kids. I had to take care of the little wife sitting at home. And I find now a lot of that pressure is eased because I realize that it's in an equal relationship, the financial responsibility is equal. I no longer have to feel like everyone is dependent upon me. I can be human now.
That panel was moderated by KPFK's Everett Frost, director of theater and literature. The men on the panel included Jeremy Shapiro, a professor of the California Institute for Arts and author of the essay Men's Liberation. I'm not entirely clear what Fraser is going to do with this audio. Here's an excerpt from one of her performance works titled May I Help You. She is performing this at an art museum.
It's a beautiful show, isn't it?
You fall in love with a thing that pleases you and you can't resist it. Who are these people? Where do they get their money? What does all this have to do with money? The manipulators. I think it takes a pretty blind state of euphoria.
Clip from an Andrea Fraser performance piece. Given this presentation, will Fraser view the KPFK program ironically, supportively, postmodernistically? I don't know. But I like the idea of a performance artist reenacting an old community radio show. Check it out at the Brava Theater on October 30th in San Francisco. The event is a benefit for the Pacifica Foundation, Pacifica Radio Archives. This is Matthew Lasar for the Radio Survivor podcast with one more clip from that 1972 Men on Feminism program.
I got support through most of my married life from the people around me telling me I'm a good father, I'm a good husband. Now, why are you having trouble in your relationship with your wife, you know? And they tended to support it because they bought the whole male role and the whole female role. They weren't aware of what was real equality in a relationship and how a relationship could grow.
We get tracked to this from, you know, from the time of delivery.
I guess we're all in a way, you know, somewhat nervous about doing this. We'd confessed this before. We should confess it on the air as well.
True.
There are likely to be pauses.
Again, these radio commentaries by Matthew Lasar were produced 8 years ago. So everything, all dates mentioned are in the past. Well, to round out today's hour-long program, I'm going to play one more Matthew micro radio documentary that he used to produce for this program back when we were just getting going, and then we'll say goodbye.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields.
That was Edward R. Murrow, reporting for CBS in 1940 during the Nazi air blitz on London. He
He was talking to people around the world via shortwave AM. This is Matthew Lessar with Lessar's Letter on Radio. Lots of people have written about Murrow's broadcasts, the significance of them, the politics of them, the impact of them. What very few observers have noticed is how Murrow took the time to just let his listeners, well, listen.
A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that big column. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue.
This was new, I think. Compare Murrow's communiques to a live media event of just a few years earlier. Journalist Herbert Morrison's coverage of the fiery crash of the Hindenburg Zeppelin in 1938.
Just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's crashing. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's...
Morrison just can't stop talking.
Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a
Edward R. Murrow, on the other hand, excelled in long pauses that allowed his listeners to hear London while following his broadcast. Murrow understood that the Battle of London was the story, not him. That, ironically, is one of the reasons why we remember him. This is Matthew Lessar for the Radio Survivor podcast, signing off.
Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. There goes another bus. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
Again, those were radio commentaries produced by Matthew Lessar, co-founder of Radio Survivor. My name is Eric Klein. Today's radio program was produced by myself, as well as Brian Edwards Tiekert. Brian edited and produced the interview with Matthew Lessar back in 2013, as well as finding all those delightful clips from the archives. Thank you so much, Brian. Well, Radio Survivor can be found online at radiosurvivor.com. We're a podcast where you can subscribe and listen anywhere where you get your time-shifted radio. If you'd like to send an email, the address is podcasts@radiosurvivor.com. On behalf of Jennifer Waits, Paul Riesmandel, and Matthew Lessar, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week.